We're on. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our session on Deep Dive into Access 2013. My name is Greg Lindhorst, and with me is Bob Piper. We're program managers on the Microsoft Access team. So I'm not talking. Are we turned up? Can you hear us now?
Great.
All right, perfect.
Check.
Very good. So we'll be covering what's happening with Access, what the transition has been from the existing Access to the new Access that we've built in 2013. I'll be taking us through a getting started experience, showing you how to get started with Access 2013, the different ways of building and creating your first database. Then we'll go into two of the big areas of the product, the two tiers, if you will, how you define user interface and how you work with the data. We kind of separated those out for good reasons, and I want to walk through each individually. And we'll get to some advanced topics. How do you expose Access data to external tools such as SSMS, Excel, or Access the client itself? Linking to SharePoint lists and backup, packaging, and publishing. How do you move a database from one machine to another? But as you probably are aware, Access is enjoying its 20th anniversary today, or actually yesterday. It released 20 years ago yesterday. And in honor of that, I'm planning to do this entire talk old school, which means this slide and all the slides that follow are just text. I don't plan to use pictures
Stop.
No fonts.
Stop. These people came from all over the world, and you're going to make them sit there for an hour reading your slides?
No, I was planning to read the slides.
No, that is not okay. We need pictures. We need demos. Who's with me on this? We need pictures. We want pictures. We want demos. See? Let's start.
I'll
over.
Give you a picture. All picture.
Oh.
This is old school.
Oh.
This is the way art was done 20 years ago.
Did
the
you
way
do
it
that
should
all
still
by
be
yourself?
Done. I did.
Wow.
Character by character. ASCII rules. All right, you want color probably, don't you?
Please.
Pixel pusher. All right. We'll give you some color.
Oh.
All right, so Access, for the last 20 years, we've had a long legacy of products, Access 1.0 through Access 2010. And they've all been fundamentally wrapped around database files, MDB files, ACDB files. We've dabbled in some other ways to approach the problem, ADPs, DAPs, do you sound a ring bell? Last release, we did web databases on top of SharePoint. But we still always had the focus around database files. This release, we've changed this. We are very much now about SQL Server and SharePoint. That is our default. That is the primary way we expect and hope people will be building databases into the future. And we'll go through a bunch of reasons why that is a better alternative. That doesn't mean that database files are gone or not supported. We probably will support those for a very long time into the future. There's tons of solutions that are built on top of database files. More are being generated still even today. That's going to be a part of Access for a long time. But all of our investment, all of our focus is going to be squarely on SQL Server and SharePoint. When we went out to do this change, this makeover, we looked at three main things we were trying to do. First, we were trying to enable people to build apps really quickly, really easily. We wanted to enable anyone to build an app. So that meant providing things like templates for full apps that they could further customize. It included things like table templates where they could take pieces of schema that were already meant to connect together like Lego blocks and pull that in and use that as the building blocks, the basis for their application. We want to make it lower the bar considerably. We wanted the result to be something people really wanted to use, not just merely an app, but an app that you go, wow, that looks nice, that looks modern. That looks like something I want to spend time in all the time to get my information, my business well organized. So it needed to be efficient, it needed to look good, and we wanted to be something that end users would go, yeah, that's the kind of app I want to be using. And then finally, control. What we've heard talking to Access people for eons is one of the main problems that's developed over the last two decades is these database files get created, they're strewn all over people's desktop machines, they're not centrally managed, they don't know who has permissions, they don't even know where they are, how they exist, they're unmanageable. And so by placing everything in SQL Server and giving the IT people a chance to control where that stuff goes, it brings more control to that mayhem. In terms of the skill sets we were after, you can think of the spectrum of people that might use Access. On one end, the pro developer, And on the other end, the power user, or we actually try to drive even further out to the end user. That's a wide spectrum. And we kind of got here over time. Initially, if you look at back at the early versions of Access, they were much more focused on the person who was just trying to get a solution built. Very simple. And over time, it has developed more and more complexity, more and more features that enable developers to take better advantage of it. And that's not all bad, but it lost focus on what was going on at the low end. So we have very much deliberately gone after the low end this time around. We're after, with 2013, people that potentially could build an Excel workbook, being able to build their first application and deploy it themselves. Now, there's stepping stones up from there. There's things like NAPA, which you've heard about this week. It's a lightweight tool that allows you to write JavaScript and build up SharePoint apps. That's great. And then, of course, there's Visual Studio. They're all on a spectrum, with Access being at the bottom, and that we're intentionally there, and we want to be there, to enable everybody to be able to do this. Now, the two bars in the middle, they talk about apps for SharePoint and apps for Office. Access apps are apps for SharePoint. They're one and the same. We produce apps for SharePoint. Our apps are managed as apps for SharePoint. They're deployed as apps for SharePoint. We're all about that. Apps for Office are wrapped around Excel and Word and Outlook and adding value to those existing clients. At this time, we don't play in the apps for Office world. We think we probably will over time. We'll get there. But right now, for this release, we don't have any play there. Almost everything I'll be showing you today is available on the preview right now. You can go out, install it, play with it, and we'd love to get your feedback. We'd love to understand what you like about it, what you don't like about it, as we prepare for the future releases that we have coming. And we're trying to release on a more rapid cadence. Now, you do need to, the circle down here is explaining that there's a couple SKUs of Office 365 that you need to have in order to get Access. The bottommost SKU does not include Access. So make sure you get one of the top ones.
Demos.
What was that?
Nothing.
Pixel boy. So getting started. But now we've covered the preamble. We've covered a lot of the stuff that we showed at Steve and Kevin's talk yesterday. I'm going to start with getting started. How do you start with Access 2013? Let's talk about entry points. There's three main ways that you get started. One is you start from SharePoint. Instead of firing up Access and saying, I want a new database, instead you can be on SharePoint and say, I'd like a new app here, in this site, for this purpose. And it's more directed. And so you can use that as an entry point to get started, either picking an app that's already built and customizing it, or creating a new app from scratch in that context. You can be handed an app package, a SharePoint app package that was built with Access, and you can deploy that directly. And this is a great way to move things from one machine to another. And then you can actually boot up the Access client, and you can point at a SharePoint site and say, put that Access database there, if you like. Table templates is a new feature we added this time around. It's a set of schema that interconnect, and we'll be showing an example of those. And those are extensible over time. They're updated from office.com automatically, and we hope that those will be helpful to people to get started. And then finally, no Access app really is an island. There's a lot of other systems and information that needs to be brought together to be useful to an Access app. And so we'll be covering how you import existing data.
You're just reading slides now.
To get it into
this is boring.
The Access app.
This is boring.
But I read
demos.
It really well.
We need demos. Who's with me? We need demos. Demos! Demos!
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Security?
All right, well, if we do demos, it's going to be on my terms.
What
Old school.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, let's go take a look, shall we? Yes, baby.
Oh, no.
Let's create a database file, shall we? The way it was meant to be done.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Put some information in there. You got to remember the Control-Z. Don't forget the Control-Z.
Oh.
And I've got my first database file. Now, this is a completely useful tool. I can do queries, and I get back results. I see no problem with this.
Make it stop.
Works great.
Please make it stop.
20 years ago, this was nearly state-of-the-art. Well, let me show you what state-of-the-art was 20 years ago. Here we go, baby.
Oh.
Yes, pixels. Program manager. Look familiar? Comes Access.
Ow.
Let's create a new database. File new database.
Oh, my
yes.
eyes.
Yes, an MDB. The reason I'm taking us down memory lane is largely this experience hasn't changed much up to 2010. We were all about building these files. But this is about to change. And it's not that this isn't still useful. It is, and we'll continue to support it for a long time. But really what we need to be doing is something fairly different. Instead, from your SharePoint site, you should be able to create an app directly by just saying, I want to add an app. I want an access app. And we'll give it a name. What this is going to do is it's going to go take a blank template of an access app and put it on my SharePoint site and allow me to then take it and customize it from there. So if I go to my site contents, you can see all the demo databases we've been building for the last 3 days. But down here at the bottom is the one that's currently being instantiated. As I said, these are all SharePoint apps. They're no different from every other commercial SharePoint app that you've been hearing about all week. They're in the same catalog. They're provisioned the same way. They're run the same way. And in mere seconds, it will be done. See, my text thing, it goes much faster than this. I'm telling you, there's advantages. It's coming back.
Pick a different one.
I tell you, pixels, they kill me. I would pick another one, but it's not going to bode well for the rest of the demo. Question was, is this RTM code? Absolutely. Not quite, actually. The general GA is coming in a few months, and that'll be an update to this code. In a few months. All right, I'll go elsewhere. Let's see what's behind door number two. Here's an app. Look at that. It's very similar to the one I was about to build. This app is living in SharePoint. It's an order entry app. The way it was created is I was in Access. Disturbing, really. I was here and I said I wanted orders. And I picked orders. Oh, I'm just going to do it again. Great. Orders will bring with it a bunch of related tables. Orders will bring order details, it'll bring customers, it'll bring employees, it'll bring interrelated tables and hook up the lookups automatically. And the next thing it's going to do is build a bunch of UI on top of that. It's going to build forms and a basic app model around it for navigation so people can get around easily. My goodness, is that taking a while? After it's built, everything that we do in Access is live against the server. We build tables, we build forms, we save them. There's no publish step like we had in the previous version. Instead, it's live against the site. And so as I make changes, I can go to the site directly and see those changes immediately. So I can go to customers, I can add a new customer. And save that. So, delay glitches aside, it is relatively easy and pretty quick to build an app in Access. Directly off of SharePoint. Now let me show you a different model for doing this. Imagine you have Northwind. Northwind should be familiar with everybody in the room. It's been around for eons as well. What you'd love to be able to do is take the schema and data from an app that already exists, that you're already dependent on, and be able to move that to the web very easily. And so to do that, I'm going to create a new web database, not this second-class citizen desktop thing, but a new web one. Maybe I picked the wrong number. Let's go 54. And I'm going to point it at the web, the SharePoint site directly. This is in Office 365. And it'll go ahead and create that database in SQL Azure. Then it'll also create a companion site on SharePoint, connect the two together, and give me a basic app. And this one will be empty, hopefully.
You might also want to mention that in the client there, when you're creating your app, you can choose where it's located, or else IT can choose where it's located.
That's true.
So IT gets control. They don't have to deal with access apps popping up like mushrooms everywhere.
That's our goal, for sure. So now that I've done that, I've got this blank app. I've got the table templates like I showed you previously. But instead of doing that, I'm going to import data from Northwind. So I'm going to point it at that database, existing ActDB, select all tables, and have it import. And what's going to do in the background is it's going to take each of the tables and move the schema for it up to SQL Azure and make a table in SQL Azure for it. It's also going to populate the data that's in Northwind currently and move each of those rows up to the database as well. And then it's going to create the relationships, the lookups from one table to another, and honor all of those. Now, there's things like VBA and reports and other objects that are in the client, the old Access client, that will not be moved forward. A little later, I'll be showing you a way to connect the existing Access client to that SQL Azure database, and then you can continue to take advantage of those technologies. But for right now, the web database doesn't include those, and so those won't be migrating as part of what I'm doing right now. Things are slow, very, very slow. But they are working. I'll give it that credit. Nobody's got their foot on the pipe, do they? That they got a kink in it? It's real slow, way slower than it was. It's a cloudy day. I like that. Perhaps it's raining in Chicago. If you use the what? Amsterdam is faster. We may switch over to that. Okay, while that's going on, let me show you one other example. This is the database I was working with a minute ago. The other thing I wanted to show you is that you can save applications as a package. This is a way of taking it out. You know, we're putting all this stuff into Azure. How do I get it out again? This is the way. You create a package, then I can instantiate this package in an app catalog somewhere else, or we will shortly be able to just directly upload that to another SharePoint site and use it in that manner. Okay, the import finally finished. The error messages are expected. Not every data type that existed in the old Access client is available in the new world, and in particular, attachments we don't have in the new world. So things like pictures for people, such as employees, won't be here, and you'll have to go make some manual updates to the database as a result of that. But most of the app is there. So if I launch it, here's a representation of Northwind. It has all the schema and all the data that exists in the previous version of Northwind. And I can click around, I can go to employees. And it even honored the relationship, such as being able to show me what the privileges are for the employee. So this bottom portion of all the apps communicates the one-to-many relationships between the detail form and the different tables that you might have that one-to-many relationship with, such as privileges, such as orders that this person has made. Whew, things are way slow. Okay, we may have to shift gears as a result, but we'll take care of that. So anyway, I just got started building some applications, and let me switch back to slides for a moment. We talk about architecture and what you just saw. What you just saw was everything I was doing in terms of what the end user would interact with was in the web browser. We're completely focused on the web browser as our endpoint right now. In the future, I suspect we'll go to other endpoints as well. We've architected such a way that we can move to other endpoints. But right now, we're all about the browser. The browser talks to SharePoint in order to, as its host for those web pages and as its middle tier for getting data in and out, which in turn talks to Azure or SQL Server. We work both on-prem as well as in the cloud. There's a parallel pipe for design time, which I can't click. There it goes. Where the Access Client, everything I was doing in terms of modifying the app, customizing the app, building the app, was done in the Access Client. That's our design time. And it has a different pipe that talks through the same mechanism to make modifications to the database. An important point to understand about this new version of Access is we've teased apart the stuff that's UI from the stuff that's data. In the past, those were kind of glommed together. And in looking at a whole bunch of Access databases and talking to a bunch of customers, what we found is that it became spaghetti VBA code, where there would be a little bit that would be responding to an event from a button click, and then it would go off and it would go do some data stuff in a record set, and it would come back and update some label captions. It was really hard to understand. It was really hard to maintain. So we've tried to make a separation between the stuff that really should be UI-based and the stuff that should be data-based. It also meant that we could move all the UI stuff into the browser as client-side code, as JavaScript and HTML. It didn't need to do postbacks. It didn't need to come back to the server in any way. It could be self-contained and do its work, and it could be very efficient at being doing its work there, very responsive to the user, and communicating back to the server only when it needed to get data. It also meant that the data now is all about business logic. That's where business logic is better served. It can ensure that even if we change the UI, even if one of your users or one of your developers adds a form, that it doesn't violate the existing UI, the existing business logic that was there previously by having them separated. Now, since I'm not the pixel guy, I'm going to hand it over to Bob. He's going to talk you through the user interface.
Thanks a lot, Greg. All right. So Access 2013 provides a clean, consistent, and we think beautiful runtime right out of the box. All of our views are based on the modern web standards, HTML and JavaScript, so they run perfectly on all the top browsers. App builders get default views, navigation, and create, read, update, and delete functionality without writing any code at all. Since these features are already provided, this frees up app builders to concentrate on creating the business logic specific to their needs. In Access 2013, content is king. Customizing the UI of an Access app is limited. Users can choose themes from SharePoint, or they can do a few limited customizations, which I'll show you in a moment. This railed experience prevents app builders, like Greg, from making really poor UI decisions.
Thanks, Bob.
Let me quickly walk you through the Access app model. So here is a slide showing an Access 2013 app. And like all Access 2013 apps, down the left side is a list of tables. These tables contain your data. The first thing we expect users to do in the runtime is to choose a table. Next, across the top, is the view selector. All of these views correspond to the table that's been chosen. So it's choose the table and then choose the view. Next, the user is expected to filter down to the exact record that they're looking for. And this filter and search functionality is built into every Access app without any code. The details area is the area where all the editing takes place. And the action bar is a place where you can take action on all of the data in your record. Now, there are a few limited customizations within this framework. On the left, users can add new tables or change the icons associated with those tables. Across the top, they can add new views. They can change the fields that are represented in the list. They can add new buttons to add more actions. And probably the area with the most freedom is in the layout area, where controls can be moved around or removed altogether. So yes, these customizations are limited. There are three main reasons that we do this. First, as we talked about before, it's so app builders make the right choices. We know from studying thousands of Access apps that this content-centric approach is the best one. App builders can then concentrate on displaying the data that is most important for their business. Second is consistency across the Access apps. So whether I build the app, or Greg builds the app, or any of you builds the app, it will act the same way, so you'll know how to use it. This also ensures that in the future, if Access decides to change the all-up UI, it's not going to break existing apps. And third, it allows Access to be prepared to get onto mobile devices in the future. So that covers customizations. But what if I want to do something like provide a shortcut that gets a user quickly from one part of the app to another? This is where UI macros come in. What is a UI macro? A UI macro is something that is used for things like app navigation. It's used for filling in values in a control or checking that the data in that control is valid. UI macros can make calls to data macros, but they cannot directly manipulate data. They can indirectly manipulate data by manipulating a data-bound control. But a UI macro cannot, for example, iterate through a record set. And debugging is limited to a message box and exceptions. So UI macros really address a small number of scenarios. But now let's watch a video. This app uses all of the customizations we've talked about and a whole lot more. Then we're going to show you the app in the Access client to show you how it was built.
You want to flip me over?
While we worked to put the finishing touches on Access 2013, we contacted some businesses to try it out and see how easy it is to create an app that meets their particular needs. During this effort, we contacted Caroline Traub from McKinstry.
At McKinstry, we do building energy audits, looking for energy savings for our customers. We use a lot of different audit tools, loggers, temperature sensors. Right now, they're difficult to locate and track. Without a checkout check-in system, tools get left on site at individual workstations or hidden in the tool room. After doing a web search and talking with colleagues, we couldn't find a simple solution that immediately met our region's needs.
We worked with Caroline, and using Access, created a simple tool tracker app for McKinstry. This is just the type of app we hope users can create on their own, or else they can go to the SharePoint store, download a free Access app, and tailor it to their own needs. A main requirement for this app was that it was easy to use. We want users to come in, check out their tools, and be on their way. The dashboard page has buttons for the most common tasks. We've integrated a barcode scanner to quickly filter to the tool being checked out. Once the tool is checked out, it appears in the checked out list. Bulk checkout can be used to check out many tools at once. Simply scan them in and click the checkout button. Here, a job name can be added. Again, now that they are checked out, the tools appear in the checked out tools list. Simple.
The web app solution was affordable, easy, and ready to implement.
Check it out at office.com/preview. Choose the option for small business to get started.
All right, so now let's take a look at that app running in the browser. And here you can see the app model at work. Down the left side is a list of the tables holding your data. Across the top are the different views available for each of these tables. This is the all tools list. Down the left side shows a list of all the tools. On the right, the details of each of the tools in the table. And then, of course, the action bar up at the top to take action on this data. Now, I really like this view, but let's say I want to customize it a little bit. I can click on the charm in the upper right corner and click Customize and Access, and this will open it in the Access client. So that was the all tools view. I'm going to open that view in the Designer by double-clicking. And here it is in the Design Canvas. Something I think would be nice is if I was to move the description of the tool right up underneath the picture. Right after I break your eardrums. So all I need to do is to grab the control, move it where I want, and then drop it. You can see that when I let go, it moves to be aligned with the rest of the controls on this view. That's because the design features a grid underneath to help you with app building. I'm going to save this view. Then we're going to look at it in the browser to look at the changes. I'll refresh this view. Go back to the All Tools list. And now you can see that the description of the tool is right up underneath the picture. Great. Okay, well, so we've changed a view, but now what if we'd like to add a new view? Let's go back to the client. And take a look at the view selector. Here are all the views we just saw in the browser, and then there's a plus button. I'm going to click this to add a new view. I'd like a view that gives me a list of all the tools split up by their location. So I'm going to call it by location. And the view type we want is not list details, it's not the data sheet, but it is the summary type. And this comes out of the box to enable just such a scenario. So now our view's been added, but we do need to tweak it a little bit, so I'll double click. And on the left side, you see item name, but that's not what I want the group by to be. I'll click on the data charm. It says here group by, item name. Well, that's not right. I want to group by storage location. Now let me save this view. Then we'll open it again in the browser. Now you see that we've added the by location view right into our app. Down the left side are a list of all the locations, a count of the number of tools in each of those locations, and then on the right, the actual tools. And you notice when I click on a tool, it drills through right to that table and shows me the details about that tool. So now we're really getting somewhere. But I'd like to add another view. And I really like the look of this all tools list view. But I think I'd really like it to show just the tools located in the garage. Now, am I going to have to spend a whole bunch of time duplicating this? No, I don't.
You just died.
All right. So, I said I really like the all tools list view. What I'm going to do is now show you one of my favorite app building tricks. I can right click on this view and choose duplicate. And that's going to take an exact copy of this particular view. And I'm going to call it garage tools. And I get to pick a location for this view. Typically, you would leave it right with the items to inventory list. I have items to inventory table, excuse me. But you could, in certain instances, want to put it to be associated with one of your other tables. Or you might want to end up using it as a standalone or a pop-up for a different scenario. In this case, however, I will leave it with the items to inventory table. I'll click OK. And now we've created the garage tools list view. However, this is still going to show all of the tools in the list. B- because my record source is items to inventory. Well, I want it to show garage tools. Can I just look in this record source and see garage? No, I can't. So what I'm going to have to do is to create a query, which just takes a slice of the data in the items to inventory and shows me only the tools. So for that, I'm going to create a query. So I go up to the ribbon, I click Advanced and choose Query. Now this is the Query Builder. It should be familiar to any of you who have used Access in the past. I just need one table, and it's the items to inventory. So I'll add that. I do want to be able to show all of the fields, so I'm going to double-click the star, which brings down all of the fields into my query. But I don't want to show all the data from all the fields. I only want tools that are in storage location equal to garage. So I'll save this query. Call it garage tools. Close it. Now when I go back to the data charm, let me reopen that. Now when I go back to the data charm, I see my query right in the list of record sources. So I'll click Garage Tools, hit Save. Now go back to the app in the browser, refresh it. Now we see a list of garage tools. So now the layout looks exactly the same as the All Tools list view. But if we click through the records, we can see that they are only the ones located in the garage. So I'll have a little bit more later, but now back to Greg.
Thanks, Bob. More text, just what I want. Database Engine. So we had kind of abstracted the UI layer. We built on top of HTML and JavaScript, but we don't expose HTML and JavaScript directly in the product. You can't directly manipulate it. And we get that common question, get that question a lot. Can I do that? The answer is no, because we're trying to leave it abstract so we can move to other platforms and other entry points in the future. The data tier, however, we're making a hard bet on SQL Server. And we've tried to make it as clean as possible, the interface between what we do in Access and what we do in SQL. So for example, an Access app is equal to one and only one SQL database. When you spawn up an Access app, we create a SQL database, everything goes in that one database. An Access table is equal to a SQL table, one for one. An Access field, a SQL field, one for one. Access data types are a subset of what's available in SQL. And we did rename a few. We thought that NVARCHAR wasn't the most easy to understand for end users, so we renamed that to short text. Expressions, we did a similar thing. It's subset to a degree. We also renamed a few things, such as the fact SQL doesn't have a Boolean type, and we want people to say yes or no. So we translate for the end user, yes and no. So we put a veneer, a very light veneer on top, to help end users make a sense of the SQL world. Access queries become SQL views, one for one. Access data macros become SQL stored procedures and or triggers, one for one. And we talk about data macros a little bit in more depth. Bob built a UI macro. There's a set of actions there for manipulating UI, like changing the view, throwing a message box, impacting or changing the value of a control. But it doesn't ever touch the data tier. All of that's relegated to data macros. And these guys are responsible for iterating record sets, doing bulk updates, doing complex data validation, and cascading changes. One table changes, and it can cause other changes to occur. It cannot interact with the UI. It has no message box. It has no ability to tell the UI layer, hey, switch from this view to this other view. It's all about expressing business logic and ensuring that the database stays consistent. All data macros run in a transaction automatically. The user doesn't have to think about that. So whenever a data change of any kind is made, if there's a trigger that causes data macros to fire, they are all wrapped in the same transaction. So if there's a problem with that data macro down the line, it all rolls back. And this is essentially how we do validation. You can get deep into the data macro world, run up a couple triggers, and find that something isn't quite right, that something that the user has entered is invalid. And it all rolls back. And the user gets a message that says, that was incorrect. You need to change what you put in here it needs to be different. And either the user needs to make a correction or it needs to go back to the app author to make appropriate corrections. Debugging, it's not like you can connect Visual Studio directly to it. That'd be very nice, but we're not quite there yet. What we do have is the ability to essentially do a debug.print or do a printf, which is just throw up some UI, which we use most of the time for getting information out of what's happening in a running data macro through RaiseAir. And then we also have a new facility called tracing, where we can actually trace and record every action that the data macro makes. And we can give that to you in a table form so you can see this trigger fired at the change in this row, which caused this trigger to fire, and these are the things it did. And you can see where the inputs and the outputs were and make sense of it, hopefully. All right, with that, let me switch over and do a demo of the data layer. Thanks, sir. Oops, not so long. Now, data layer demos seem to be, they're not so spiffy. They're about text and data types and geeky things like that. This is a table. This is one of the tables in this application. It has auto numbers, lookups, date time, short text, et cetera. The reason I'm bringing this up is that I'm also going to bring it up in SSMS. This is exactly the same database that we're looking at in Access. I can open up and I can look at the tables, and I see that there's a set of tables with the access.schema. Those are the tables that the user has contributed. Those are the user tables. There's a set below that of access services dot, which are, or access system dot. Those are the tables that our system maintains with the metadata for the application, the HTML pages, the other stuff that we generate that makes the app work. And we actually do store the HTML and JavaScript for the runtime in the database. It's not in SharePoint. It's here, and we spoon it out when SharePoint needs it. If I open up that same table, I can open it up and I can see that things like email is a short text in Access becomes an nvarchar 220 here. Things like return date become a date field. Job name is an int, which is a lookup to some other table. A long text becomes an nvarchar max. So there's a mapping between what's happening in Access and directly what's happening in SQL. Now our hope is over time, well, there's two hopes. One is we open up this now so that people can manipulate and see the data in the database. We'll be showing you an example later where Excel and Access can directly connect to this database to get information out of it. But over time, we expect to be able to open this up more for people to actually manipulate these objects more directly. Now, let me show you a different aspect of the database tier, and that's keeping things consistent. There's a number of declarative ways to tell the system how things should be. There's validation rules at the table level, constraints in SQL language. There's validation rules at the field level. There's required fields, something you can say that this can't be null, essentially, in SQL. Indexes can be applied, which can prevent duplicates in the data table. So there's all these ways that you can apply rules to the data to try to help keep it consistent. But there's another way, which are these event macros here at the top, on insert, on update, and on delete. These are triggers. So when you do one of those three actions, a set of code will run. As I described earlier, that code can go ahead and bail out of the transaction if it needs to. So I'll get back to that in a minute. Yep. The question was, are these SQL triggers? The answer is yes, they are SQL triggers. Finally, I want to show you queries. We touched on those a moment ago. But I'm going to, let me motivate why I'm doing this. If I go back to the dashboard, what I'd love to be able to do is at the bottom of this, which I can't scroll to, I'd love to be at the bottom of the dashboard be able to show how many things are currently checked out, which requires an aggregate query. Something else we didn't have in the last version of Access was aggregates, and we had to maintain aggregates the hard way. Now, because we have the SQL query engine, it's much, much simpler. So to make that work, I'm going to go ahead and create a query. The question was, is the SQL view still there? The answer is it is not still there. So you are limited to what you can do in terms of queries as to what the QBE, the query by example editor, can do for this release. But I suspect over time we'll head that direction. Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and total or count the IDs for which available is equal to true. Or yes. Sorry about that. I'm going to mute this. Let me get to that in a moment. Total available. So there's 9 total available things that are available to be checked out. That's an aggregate of what's in the database returned as a query into the data sheet. What I want to do, though, is I want to show this on that main form. So let me close that. Go back in here. And what I'm going to do is bind this main form, which doesn't currently have any data binding, really, to that query. And then I can go down at the bottom here and add some labels. Whoa. And you see it auto sizes, helping us not pixel skilled deal with it. So now I can bind this label to that field that came back from the query. Save that. Go back to the app. Now down at the bottom of the dashboard, it tells me how many things are available to be checked out. And to make it work, I'll go ahead and check something out. If I go back to the dashboard, it should say 8, which it does. Nice. So it's doing this error query, returning that value in this record set, and making it available on this dashboard. Now, there are situations in which you want to nest record sets, where there might be, if that main form had been data bound, where I want to data bound something inside there to something else, like the query. And we have subviews like we had in previous version, where you can bring out a subview, and you can bring out a subview control, and you can set up essentially a region of binding that's a different record set than what the main form already has. But for lack of time, I'm not going to go through that today. Well, let me go ahead and check this back in. I've got this cool shortcut I use in the data sheet to do that.
Whoa. Not there. Don't check it in there.
What do you mean not there?
Well, you're supposed to go to the checked out tools list and click a button and it opens a pop-up and then you check it back in.
But I'm a user. I'm going to do whatever I want to do with this app, especially when it looks like text like that. I'm much more comfortable with that.
No. Don't let me show you how it's done. Look, I'm going to open this up in the client. Now, the view that you need is called check-in 2. So I'll open it up and show you how it's done. When the user fills in their data and then clicks this pretty button here, the on-click action runs the check-in macro. It's cool, huh?
I think I see your problem.
That's not a problem. It's beautiful.
That's a problem.
It's perfect.
And the good news is there's a solution. We can fix it. We can make it better. We can make you better, Bob.
Okay.
Let me show you how it's done. The problem he has is that this UI macro is instantiated from one part of the UI, one form. If I take any other path to modifying that available bit, it bypasses this code because it's not associated with the data. It's associated with the UI. And this is the problem that we run into with Access apps over the years, is people would put a bunch of business logic to forms, and then they'd create a new form, and none of that would work because it wasn't going through the same path any longer. So if we rewrite this so that it's done at the data tier instead of at the UI tier, using data macros that are triggers, then any entry point would benefit from that business logic. Ready to see that?
That sounds fair.
All right, let's try it out. So what Bob has in the application, he's got this one table that has a bit which says it's available or not. And he has another table which has the record of what's checked out. And if the record of what's checked out, if the return date is not filled in, that means it's checked out. But essentially there's duplicate data here. There's something in this table that mirrors something in another table. In proper database design, you wouldn't have that. You'd create queries so that there wasn't duplication of information. But that can become tedious and hard and doesn't really help me in making this demo. So I didn't do that. Instead, I'm going to use triggers to keep these two tables in sync instead. So to avoid the problem I would have had, if I were to click this button, then all of a sudden this table would think it was checked in, but the other table would not think it was checked in. So to fix that, I'm going to put a data macro on this that says, when I try to update this table, and if I'm going to make it inconsistent with the other one, stop me, prevent me from doing it, and roll back the change. So because it's a data macro, I'm going to go to the data. Oops, wrong table. And I'm going to write an after update. So this macro is going to run anytime one of the rows is updated, like me setting the available flag to true. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look up the other table's item. Which is in checkout history. And I'm going to look for the thing that's linked between them. I'm going to look for checkout history.item that's equal to this guy's ID. The lookups in the system are based on ID, so the ID column is what I'm triggering off of for the lookup to make sure I get the right one. So now I have both the record that I'm looking for in the checkout history table and the one that I'm looking for in the items table. And since there could be more than one of these guys, I need to make sure I get the last one, if there is one, that doesn't have a return date.
Oop, return date.
Sorry. Got it. So if I look in the other table and I find a record that shows that it's still checked out, and this guy is trying to say that it should not be checked out, by saying it's yes, oops, I'm going to go ahead and raise an error. Saying, no, you can't do this.
Ah, that's great.
You notice it's text and not pictures, though. All right, now if I go back here, I try to click that to change this row, and I move off, it's going to give me the error message that says, no, no, sorry, you can't do that because this now is inconsistent with the other thing. So I've just fixed his bug, and I essentially moved code he had in the UI macro into the data tier so it could be used from any UI entry point. Let me continue on that thread. So here's the other table. When I insert something here, I'm going to do something that's very similar. I'm going to look up the record in the items table. I'm going to look up the same one. Oops. So this is an after insert. So if I'm inserting this, I'm saying that I'm checking something out. That's why I would put something in this table. If it's already out, then that would be a mistake. That would be another data validation error. So I can say, if it's already unavailable, then raise a different error. Otherwise, go ahead and check it out. And I can do that by editing the other table directly. Whoops. So that's checkout. All the logic I need in the business, in the world for checkout. And check-in is very similar, which is on update. So I'm updating the row that had the row that said it was checked out and didn't have a return date. When I get the return date, do the same kind of thing, except in reverse. Say those about that, back out. Now, if you go look at Bob's application as it stands now, he's got these macros that he was calling from the UI tier for checking things and checking things out. I'm just going to delete those.
Hey, I spent a lot of time building those.
You don't need them anymore. If you open them up and look at them, they do very similar things. They look up one record in the other table and try to keep them up to date. But since they were triggered from the UI tier manually by calling these explicitly as opposed to triggers, the app's more fragile. It's more, I see. You come into problems more readily. And it didn't address the problem I was running into.
So instead of having to build those for each entry point, you can just build it once.
Exactly.
Great.
Now, he was calling those from his UI tier. So let's go nuke that too. That goes away. And essentially here, he just is saving the record. He doesn't have to do any business logic that's really meaningful. This is just an aid that he has at the top there. And this goes away completely as well. Now we can go back to the app. We hope. Check out a tool. And sure enough, things seem to be working. This is going to be in the checked out table, as it should be. It's great.
Very nice.
But how do we know things are really working, right? That was kind of not so viscerally interesting, was it? So let's go use another feature, which is tracing, to see what's actually happening. So open up any data macro. I can turn on data macro tracing at the top here. I can go back out here and check out something else again. Great, it's been saved. Now if I go back and say view trace table, it will take me to another runtime view of what happened. So as you might recall, we wrote these two macros. We wrote on insert for the checkout history. We also wrote on update for the items in inventory. And what checkout history did on insert, because it was inserting that row that said, okay, here's a new row that's going to have a blank for the return date. That means it's checked out. Let me go update the other table as well to reflect that same state. At the end of it, it set field item to inventory available equals zero, zero being no, which caused this other trigger to fire. And I can see that happening right here in the log. And I can clear this out and turn it on and off at will to watch what's happening inside my data macros. Okay? So that's a very blazing fast tour through data macros and how those work. Now I'm going to switch over to talking about external data, or exposing data. This is the architectural diagram I showed you previously for Access. I'll talk about a couple other aspects of it. First is authentication. At the interface between the user and SharePoint, we use SharePoint's user authentication. Read writes, contribute writes for read and read write. We also use full control in order to actually create the databases at design time. Those get mapped between SharePoint and SQL Server into SQL Auth. And this is one of the roles of that middle tier that we have on SharePoint, is it does that mapping. We use SQL Auth to map to either read or read write permissions for runtime. At design time, it can either be NT Auth or it can be SQL Auth. And that's configured when you set up the servers. When you tell SharePoint that Access Services databases should be put on this SQL Server, you can tell it either use the services account that you create, or you can go ahead and use SQL Auth. Another service that the middle tier does is it handles all the cursoring and handles caching of data to provide to the browser. So we have paging of the information. When we walk through it, it's carefully going, here's the first 50 rows, here's the next 50 rows. It's keeping track of where the cursor is and moving through it in an appropriate manner. And that's also done by the middle tier. Now, the reason I brought up the authentication primarily is there's another way to talk to the SQL database. You can use those same SQL authentication roles, the reader and the reader-writer roles, to also connect to it via Excel and Access Client to do reports and SSMS to look at the database like we were doing a moment ago. So let me give you an example, show you some of this.
Good question.
Yep. It's a long story. The question was, why are we using SQL Auth there? Ideally, we would be funneling SharePoint authentication all the way to the back end. But right now, SQL doesn't support claims. So we can't, there's no mechanism for us to use the same authentication mechanism all the way from the front, the web front ends, all the way through to SQL. So that's why the mapping is required. Yep. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, but let me keep going, and then please ask your question in a moment. I'm almost done. Sorry, where am I?
Exposing data.
Yep, exposing data. So out here in the backstage, I don't know what we call it anymore. There's two buttons. One is create a report and manage my connections. I'm going to create the create report button first. And it's asked me to create an Access database. This is going to create a client database and then automatically connect it up to the SQL Azure database that I have out in the cloud. And from this place, I can use all the same technologies I'm accustomed to using in Access, such as creating reports. It's the primary reason we put it here. So I've got all the tables. They're automatically linked for me. So I can do things like items to the items inventory table. I can go ahead and say create and use the report wizard to very quickly build a banded report. Sorted, all the stuff that you would expect to do in the Access client is available here, connected to that back-end service. It's all live data, it's refreshable, et cetera. I can also just open the data here as well. So you can run VBA against that data, you can interact with it just like any other ODBC data source. So that's one way to get your data out of the SQL Azure thing that's part of Access 2013 and into another place that you can use it. Now, another example I'm going to do is I'm going to fire up Excel. I'm going to do the same kind of thing to bring in a report, a summary report, that I can see how many times each thing has been checked out. To do that, I'm going to go back to Access. And I'm going to create a quick query. Get out of that. Take the item name, do aggregates, take the, oh my goodness, too long. Count those guys. It's another aggregate query. Make sure it looks right here. Looks good. Over in Excel, well, first off, back in Access, I need to get the credentials for connecting to it. And that's where this connections menu comes from. I can tell it that I want to be able to connect to it from this location or from any location. So there's IP security there. I can also tell whether I want read or read write, and then to show me what the credentials are. Don't gasp, but here's a whole lot of text. I think. There we go. So here are the credentials, the information you need to be able to connect to it from some other place. And from Excel, I can go to the Data tab. And I can use one of the many different ways we have of connecting to data. So we'll go out, I'll tell it I want my query. Here's my data, and of course you can just create a graph. You're good to go. Now you have a basic report of the number of times things have been used.
Nice.
So there's various tools that you can use to get stuff in. Okay? All right, switch back.
All right.
So while he's getting set up, because I didn't set him up, linking to SharePoint lists. The one way we have of connecting an Access database to the outside in a linked manner is to a SharePoint list as part of the current site. It's only done a read only. We know this is very limiting. It's something that we need to work through into the future, but it is where we stand today with this first release.
All right, we don't have too much time left, but I think I can get through this. So here we are back in our app in the browser. And one thing that you might want to do is to add a table for subcontractors. And chances are there are many cases where you have your data already living somewhere. Something like a SharePoint list. So if I scroll down, I can see that I have a list of subcontractors kept in a SharePoint list. I'm going to copy the location of this list and go back into my Tool Tracker app. And I'm going to open it in the client.
You're already there. That works.
There we go. Okay. So what I'm going to do is to add a new table for subcontractors. You've already seen several different types of tables you can add. What I'd like to do is to add a table from an existing data source. There are multiple choices down here. And I'm going to pick SharePoint list. Copy in the location of the list that I want. And this is going to be a link to an existing table. Sorry? That one will work. So now what we've done is Access has checked that SharePoint site and looked for SharePoint lists. And here I find my subcontractors list. So I'll choose it, hit OK. I like to do things several times for effect. There we go. All right. We're beholden to SharePoint permissions, so it had to ask for my permission to make this link. So now the subcontractor's SharePoint list has appeared as a new table in my Access app. But as it stands right now, it's still standalone. I'd show it to you in the browser, but in the interest of time, I don't think I will. So what I'd like to do is actually tie it into the schema of my app. So let's say I'd like to be able to assign tools to subcontractors. I'm glad you muted it. All right, so I'm going to add an assign to field to my items inventory. And I'm going to make it a lookup as my data type. And I want it to come from another table or query, in this case, the subcontractors table. And now I'm done. I will save this. Go back to the browser and refresh. And now you see that the subcontractors list has been added. And not only that, but if I look through the list of subcontractors, you'll see a related items control that shows all the tools that have been assigned to those different subcontractors. But now I think we'll switch back to the slide deck.
Go ahead.
Yep, that's still going. All right. And then we've run out of time, I think. So
you got to talk through packaging.
Okay. Well, so we've created a really cool app, and this is still spinning. So we've created a really cool app, and there's lots of things we might want to do with that. We might want to copy it, package it up, and save it as a backup, or we might want to share it to another SharePoint site, or if we have a Microsoft developer account, we might want to package up that app and then put it into the SharePoint store, and we can become an instant millionaire. So we've enabled that by you go to the out space, you just click File, Save As Package, and there you can choose whether or not you want to include the data. So if you include the data, you get the whole schema, you get all the data and all the relationships packaged up in one place. All right, so this is a list of all the other Access team sessions. We hope you have attended some, and if not, make sure you watch them all on video. Some of the related sessions from other teams are listed here. Again, you can watch them on video. These links should help answer any questions you don't get answered. Come on up and talk to us afterwards, please. The blogs have tips and tricks about app building, which I think you'll really like.
The bottom one's a particularly interesting one. We had to document all of our protocols that the browser and the Access client use to talk to the back-end service. That's one way to extend our system, is to talk some of the same protocols. It's all documented on MSDN, and the relevant sections that are Access-oriented are listed there at the bottom.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, everybody, very much.